Kia ora, this program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Wellington Access Radio, make your voice heard.
The Quilted Bananas program plays every Sunday, 10 to 11am, with news, views and music.
A collective of presenters, advertisers, community events and discusses news of interest to lesbians, queer women and non-binary folk.
We have interviews about past and future sports and cultural events, politics, films, art shows.
The program is sponsored by the Arthur and Armstrong Charitable Trust for Lesbians.
And it plays every Sunday from 10 to 11am on Wellington Access Radio, 106.1 FM.
So that was us, our new sting, is it a sting? We'll lead in, which stars just about all of our presenters and pegs, except for me, because I was a skiver that day. This is Sue, this is Quilted Bananas. We're brought to you by the Armstrong and Arthur Charitable Trust for Lesbians, who have kindly paid for our whole year's broadcasting this year. And this show is brought to you by the Queens. The Queens of Egypt are my subject for today, and I know about nothing about them. So I've got somebody who does know about Queens of Egypt. Sarah.
Hello.
Hello. I think last time I talked to you, we were talking on the phone, so yep. That was it wasn't as clean a broadcast as hopefully this one will be. You mentioned that there were a lot of them
a lot more than most people have heard of.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
So
yeah.
We've heard of Cleopatra.
Yep. She's the biggie.
She's kind of a...
the last ruler of Egypt as a kind of independent state and, ironically, not actually Egyptian.
Yes.
Well, she was Greek by ancestry, but Egyptian. I mean, the Ptolemies have been ruling Egypt for nearly 300 years by that point. So,
yeah,
she was kind of... what would you say? Well, naturalised Egyptian, I guess.
And we've heard of Nefertiti.
Nefertiti, yep.
Yep. And we might talk a bit later about why we've heard of Nefertiti.
Mm-hmm.
When was the first of the queens?
First of the queens is interesting. This is a subject that's actually quite heavily debated. I know there's someone working over in Australia on their PhD on this actual subject itself, this question itself. When we're talking about ancient Egypt, you're roughly talking of a period of around 3,000 years. So from we now think 3,100 BC up to 30 BC, which is when Cleopatra died. And we divide these periods up into, we give them different names, so we know what we're talking about. You don't have to name the year. So you have them basically divided up into dynasties. And we divide those dynasties into pre-dynastic, early dynastic, old kingdom, first intermediate period, middle kingdom, second intermediate period, new kingdom, third intermediate period, and so on. So the early dynastic period is the point when we see the first evidence of there being a single monarch ruling the whole of Egypt. And this, a lot of our evidence around this comes from a particular site called Abydos, where there's a very early royal, kind of basically the first royal cemetery from ancient Egypt. And within that cemetery, there's a burial. So all of the big burials there that we've identified as being the burials of kings have certain things, but they have the similar architecture, they have similar indicators of the status of the person in there. And within that cemetery, there's one burial dedicated to a woman called Merneith, or Merneit, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And it has the architecture of a king, and it has the all the signifiers of a royal burial, but there's nothing actually saying that she was a monarch of Egypt. So the debate at the moment is, was Merneith actually ruling Egypt in her own right at the very beginning of Egyptian history? So this would have been around 3000 BC, 2900 BC. So she's the kind of the first name, but say there is a big discussion. We know that she was the wife of a king. We know that she was the mother of a king. We don't know if she ruled in her own right, exactly. Yet. The current thinking about it is that she was actually working as what we refer to as a queen regent. Basically, her child was too young to rule on his own. So that in that situation, the queen, the mother of the future king, would actually basically rule in his stead. So they weren't officially the monarch, but they were basically making the decisions on behalf of their child, who would then ascend to the throne in the future. So we've got it, like I say, right from the very beginning of Egyptian state history. You have this suggestion that women were enabled or facilitated into positions of power, even if they didn't necessarily then hold the full, you know, titles or the full... I think there's a book by that was published either at the beginning of this year or at late last year by Cara Cooney, and in which she basically discusses the idea that these women, although they were acting as monarchs, they were basically acting as kind of holding pattern monarchs until the next king was ready. So it's slightly different from how we understand queenship and monarchy in kind of, you know, the European sense, I suppose. So, but yeah, it's really... But you're looking right from the very beginning, so the earliest days of the Egyptian state, right to the very end. This full period has women popping up throughout history as rulers.
It's an extraordinary length of a history that's sort of got a consistent...
Oh, my, yeah. It's absolutely phenomenal. I mean, the way I always talk to people about it is basically if you went from now to 1,000 years before the birth of Christ.
Yeah.
I mean, when we try and get that timescale in our heads, it's almost unimaginable. So dealing with a state that was functioning for that long under roughly the same kind of conditions and rules and regulations and traditions, you're dealing with an absolute beast of a thing.
It's an extraordinary length of, I won't say stability, but for a you know, civilization and government and government system.
It's, well, for a lot of it, and up until probably around till the end of the New Kingdom, really. So you're looking at around maybe 1100 BC, a bit more recent than that. For a lot of it, it did remain pretty stable. I mean, when we talk about periods of instability, it's more that the overarching government wasn't functioning as well, but local government was still functioning. And this, we think, is because of where Egypt was. Basically, if you look at the map, on the north of Egypt, you've got the sea. On the east and the west, you've got desert. And at the bottom, when you go to the south, you've got the river still, but you've got a range of rapids that we call cataracts, which you can't basically sail up. So they had these kind of four natural buffer zones. And combine that with the fact that you had the Nile Valley, which flooded every year, you kind of got the perfect conditions, really, for a stable society. So as long as politically it stayed pretty stable, you were okay most of the time.
That's there's not that many kind of identifiable civilizations that have run for anything, or even a kind of sort of ethnicities and similar.
It's interesting because they tend to have, when you look at them a bit more closely, you tend to get about a 3,000 year cycle roughly between when you first hear about certain societies and cultures and then when they've disappeared completely.
Yeah.
So it seems to be this kind of loop between, you know, you start to see the beginnings of it and then it kind of peaks and then by 3,000 years later it's gone again, which is one of the things that I always kind of slightly cynically discuss about our Western civilization, that we kind of started at year zero and now we're in 2000 and something, that we're on our way out. So by 3000, no one have heard of us again. But certainly Egypt was, because of, I think, the isolation and the distinctive nature of the architecture and how the archaeology survived, is the one that really sticks in the, you know, popular consciousness, because it's so iconic, really, in our culture. And there are reasons for that. That is kind of something that came about mostly during the 19th and 20th centuries, when we started to get really excited and interested in ancient Egypt, and it became this kind of big deal to us. Yeah, Egyptomania, so, it's known as.
We all went slightly crazy about it when that's... So that was... we talked a little bit about First Queen. Who was your favourite queen?
Who's my favourite queen? Ooh, That's a difficult question. I mean, the one I think that is not necessarily my favourite, but the one that I think is the, in some ways the most sometimes misrepresented is Hatshepsut, who's the other queen that people tend to... If you know a little bit about ancient Egypt, you tend to have heard of certain monarchs. And yes. So Ramses II, for example, Tutankhamun, obviously, Hatshepsut, Akhenaten. These are the names that tend to come up. And she was basically... She ruled Egypt for, we think, around 21 years. And she's a really interesting person because she was the daughter of a king... And she was married to a king. And then when her husband died, it was her, what we would describe as her stepson, but that didn't really work that way in ancient Egypt. If a king had multiple wives, they weren't necessarily step-parents to other people's children. So it was her husband's son by another royal wife who was due to ascend to the throne, and he was only a small child, so she took on, we think she took on this role of regency. Which is not unheard of. This is not an unusual practice. The thing that became unusual with Hatshepsut is that she then, in year 7 of this, because the way the ancient, confusingly for a lot of people, the way the ancient Egyptians recorded time was by the number of years in an individual reign. So when a monarch died, the next monarch would be year 1. Yeah. And then they'd do however many years, and then when they died, the next one was year 1. So in year 7 of Hatshepsut's time on the throne as a co-regent, she did something quite unusual, which was she took on all of the titles and all of the mantles of a king. And this is where it gets sometimes gets confused in popular culture. This is when people start talking about her cross-dressing and pretending to be a man, which we have no evidence of her actually doing. So it meant that she took on the titles that a king would have. She took on the iconography, so the images and the crowns, etc., that a king would have. She had herself depicted in all of her art as the same way that a king would be depicted. She had the appropriate architecture. All of these different things you have to put in place in order to fulfil the role of being monarch. In real terms, this would be like, say, for example, I mean, we all know that Elizabeth II, the queens of and kings of England have a certain crown that they wear, a certain sceptre that they hold. So it basically was meaning that she took those things and used them for herself. And she retained this position until her death, but she was never shown as a solo monarch. She was always shown as a monarch alongside Thutmose III when he became old enough. And there's always been a... This became a really interesting situation because what happened was then in modern culture, we started kind of thinking of her as being like the wicked, evil stepmother who's stopping the rightful king from coming to the throne. And we know now that there isn't actually a huge amount of evidence for that to actually have happened. We don't know. We know that they ruled alongside each other for 21 years. He was the head of the military during this time. He was went on to become an extremely successful military leader, responsible for some of the most famous victories in ancient history. So he wasn't someone that didn't have any power. So what we're trying to figure out is how Hatshepsut, as a woman, managed to actually hold this position when there was someone who was obviously capable of doing the job by themselves. So that's the kind of mystery, really, of Hatshepsut's rule.
He might not have been that into Edmund.
Exactly. He may not have wanted the job. You do it. You're doing fine. You know, she seems to have been an amazing political leader. She achieved all of the things you'd hope for a king to achieve during the times. So there obviously wasn't a problem as far as the rest of the state were concerned with her rule. So, yeah, it's kind of... And there was always this... There's always... You sometimes read this a lot. I was reading something this morning that came up, the same thing, where, you know, she depicted herself as a man. She was a cross-dresser, all of these things. Again, as far as we know, that's not the case. If you look at statues of her, ancient Egyptian statues of monarchs have to have certain things on them to show you that it's the monarch, otherwise it doesn't work. And she would show herself with these things on, but you'd still be able to clearly see that it was a female figure. So in some ways, you almost have to think of her more as a female king, if that makes sense. So there was never any, and even in her inscriptions, so you'll see inscriptions of her alongside Thutmose III, they look exactly the same because they're both being monarchs. And one of the titles that's really interesting that a ancient Egyptian king or pharaoh has is the son of Ra, Ra being the sun god. So you're the son of the sun god. And what she has in her inscription is she has the son of Ra, but in the grammar she has this symbol, which is the female determinative. So basically she's saying, I'm the female son of Ra. So you can't get much more kind of overt that you're not pretending to be a man. She's quite clearly saying, I'm a woman in this role. Yeah, so it's, it's really interesting stuff, kind of how she was never hiding her gender at all, as far as we can tell. Yeah. But we don't know, because it's kind of an outlier. This is a problem with archaeology. If you only get one person doing something, it's really hard to figure out why they're doing it.
Right. I've been playing a piece in the background, which I think is an Egyptian group, HVNTRR, Nefertiti is what the name of the piece is. Mm-hmm. I thought that's quite a nice background. But I'm going to actually play a song, and Christine and the Queens, because that's kind of queeny.
Very on theme.
if I can figure out this left hand, right hand, right handed open with.
Sleep with ammonia, and every morning we fight so bad. I miss them for the tears they shed, but I'm actually good. Can't help it if we're tilted. I am actually good. Can't help it if we. I am actually good. Can't help it if we're tilted. I am actually good. Help it if we're tilted. Hey, Miss Prothesis and Mended Souls, trample of a beauty while singing the thoughts. Match them with my euphoria. When they said you should prefer couture, but I'm actually good. Can't help it if we're tilted. I am actually good. Can't help it if we. I am actually good. Can't help it if we're tilted. I am actually. Sortie, pire qu'une simple moitié, on compte à demi-demi. Pile sur un des bas-côtés comme des origamis. Le bras tendu paraît cassé, tout n'est qu'épié et clié. Ces enfants bizarres, crachés dehors comme par hasard, cachant l'effort dans le grifoir. Et une creepy song en étendard qui fait. Good.
That was Christine and the Queens. We'll go back to our little crap planet in the background. And I've just said to I've given some of my wish list to
you have. Yeah. Now I know where we're going.
Now I know. It's
sort of. I'm famous for going off at tangents, so
that's fine.
Brace yourself.
We enjoy our tangents. one of the things that you mentioned was the images in the art, and we just had a little chat about interpreting Egyptian art. So I hadn't realised, I think, that there was such an active hand in what the art looks like and what has to be in there and the symbology and the expectations.
Yeah.
So it's we don't interpret it in the same way as our current art.
No. Egyptian art, the best way to think of Egyptian art is its functional communication. So a piece of Egyptian art is trying to tell you something, and it's trying to tell you that through the material that's used, the colours that they use, the designs they use, the style of it. So once you get used to looking at ancient Egyptian art, you can quite clearly kind of identify things from different periods, even though to the untrained eye, you'll just say, well, that's just a king and they all look like that, or that's just someone who's standing sideways and, you know, walk like an Egyptian style. When you look at it closer, you start to understand that that's because they're trying to convey a set message. So if you think of it like writing or the alphabet, you have the alphabet is fundamentally the same, no matter where. You know, we have A, B, C through to Z, and the same with 1 to 10, but you can have hundreds and thousands of different fonts. So the Egyptian art's doing the same thing. You can change the font, but the actual structure of it has to stay the same. It has to be recognisable. So you do see through periods of Egyptian history definitely stylistic changes. The one thing that's makes it more difficult for us is that artists didn't name themselves. So we don't know who has actually produced this work. We can just see stylistic changes. And you get everything. It's quite amazing. If you look through, one of my favourite ancient Egyptian royal tombs is the tomb of Thutmose III, who I've mentioned before, who was ruled for, I think, 47 years, undertook amazing military campaigns, and was extremely powerful, extended the Egyptian empire to beyond its previous borders. And his tomb in the Valley of the Kings has extremely simple decoration. And it's basically, it looks like stick men. And that's because he's specifically, although, again, you'll still see the same kind of angles of figures, the same kind of types of headdresses, etc. And the reason we think he did that is because he wanted it to literally look like he was buried inside the pages of a script. But it's completely kind of the other extreme if you look at things like Ramses II's tomb, where it's this very detailed art. So how it's presented, as long as you've got the right elements in it, and again, bear in mind that you're providing art that serves a purpose, it's propaganda, effectively, or it's ritual, so it's got to fulfil a function. If it's not intelligible, it won't work. So you can't go... for example, tomb paintings, which are the things that we are most familiar with, they create an image of the deceased people and the deceased person's life that will last and function forever. Whatever you see depicted in the tomb painting will be happening for eternity. So you need to have the person shown as being complete, physically complete, healthy, all of these things. So if you decided that in your tomb you were going to have, you know, kind of a Picasso painting, you just spend eternity in this kind of weird vortex mush face. It wouldn't function for you at all. You wouldn't be able to eat or drink or any of these things. So, yeah, you have to kind of think of them more like a text that's been written down. So you can change it. It can be fancy, it can be simple, but it's got to have the basic ingredients have got to work.
Where I sort of first heard the was about Nefertiti being depicted differently from in early images, to the ones that really are probably what we think of as Nefertiti. Mm-hmm. So was that a deliberate change in the?
It would have been, yeah. It would have been a deliberate choice, but we just don't know why that choice was made.
Yeah,
that's the problem. And again, it's a huge amount of debate because the art Nefertiti lived during a period of around, say, 20, 25 years, which we call the Amarna period, and that's named after the site where her capital city was. She was married to Akhenaten, who started off his life as Amenhotep. And when he changed, Egyptian names have kind of literal meaning. So Amenhotep means Amun is content, Amun being the principal deity of the state at that point. And then he changed his name to Akhenaten, which is associated with a different deity, the Aten, which is the sun god. So he basically changed all of the state religion. And what happened during this time is he moved to the capital city and he changed the main god that the state was worshipping. He changed how the temples functioned. And also the art style changed quite dramatically. It looks very different to, and quite dramatically different from traditional Egyptian art as we think of it. And Nefertiti was obviously part of all of that as his principal queen. So the bust of Nefertiti that's in Berlin comes from that period when he was at his most powerful and when the Amarna-style art was at its peak. And again, so we have to... Everyone talks about Nefertiti being this great ancient beauty, but what we have is we have a unfinished statue that actually came from a workshop, so it was never completed. And it would have just been a stylistic representation of whatever message they were trying to get across. It doesn't... They're not portraits. We don't know what she looked like. Because we have, again, like you say, we have contemporary images of Nefertiti where she looks nothing like that at all. So all we know is that this statue was Nefertiti as the queen of Akhenaten, but we don't know. And if you see the images of Akhenaten, you'll see similar images of Nefertiti where they have quite narrow shoulders, really broad hips and heavy thighs and kind of bellies and things, which you don't normally expect for royal art. So it's like, well, what are they trying to tell us? What message are they trying to get across here? And it won't be a literal message of the king had a big bum. The message is... We think it's to do around basically like divine fertility and fecundity, that they're basically, you know, like the equivalent of the original beings, kind of almost like an ancient Egyptian Adam and Eve type idea. But we're not sure because they didn't actually tell us. So, yeah, we're getting into... Yeah, it's really interesting subject, especially when they do things like, you know, the reconstruction images of Nefertiti. This is what she looked like. It's like, well, we don't know. There's no way for us to know, but we can... have a kind of educated guess, and particularly when they're basing those images on statues and we know the statues aren't portraits, then you're getting into some quite kind of, you know, dubious territory.
It would probably look like someone, but
it may have looked like who the artist thought,
model
or it ideal. May have looked like, we don't know. Yeah, it looked like this. Because we know that the artist that created this, the sculptor that created it, was a royal sculptor, so it would have had to have been done with the royal go-ahead. So it would have been approved by them, but we don't know why or anything about it. So we know that Egyptian art isn't portraiture. We know that for a fact. We know it's basically the Egyptian art from the Amarna period is sticking to the rules as far as what you need to be shown with, the right kind of headdresses, the right kind of scepters, etc. The only thing that's breaking the rules is the face structure and the body shape. So, but we don't know why they're changing those rules.
So the headdress that she's wearing in that, or the cap, is different from earlier?
It was quite unusual. So it's that kind of blue flat-topped crown, which again, you don't see a lot of, but at the time that was part of the fashion. And we see that crown depicted in other royal art from that period as well. So, again, it kind of, over time, you have some basic headdresses that you always see monarchs wearing, particularly the what we call the Nemes headscarf. If you think of Tutankhamun's gold mask, that blue and white or gold striped headscarf is very common. We have the red and white crown, again, very common, goes right through history. But you also get other crowns that come in and are used during certain periods. So, things do change. Like I say, you're dealing with 3,000 years, so you can imagine it doesn't stay static. We have blue crowns, we have Artef crowns, we have all sorts of stuff. The queen can have what we refer to as the vulture headdress, which looks like a gold vulture, basically, sitting on top of her head with its wings hanging down past her ears. There's all sorts of bits and pieces that come and go. So that's not that kind of unexpected, really.
No. The... animals are kind of so there's presumably symbology attached to having a vulture sitting on your head.
There is, yes. Yeah, and that's associated again with the ancient Egyptian deities. So when the ancient Egyptian titulary of the king or the monarch has certain things, and one of them is he of the two ladies. So the king becomes he of the two ladies. The two ladies are a vulture and a cobra. So you have the vulture goddess of the south of Egypt and the cobra goddess of the north of Egypt. And so this vulture goddess is one of the primary protector deities of the king. And we think it's associated. The Egyptians didn't believe that the gods looked like, I mean, forget a great example, most famous one being Anubis, the jackal-headed man. The ancient Egyptians didn't believe that Anubis looked like a really fit bloke with a dog's head. What they believed was basically the god possessed the qualities of those creatures. So again, it's basically a metaphor. One of the reasons we think that the vulture goddess of the south was one of these metaphors, or why this particular deity was associated with the vulture, is because of there are two things about vultures. One, obviously, they hang around battlefields and carcasses and things they're involved in. You would associate them with that kind of aggression in those fields. The other thing is, and I didn't realise this till I did some study on it, that vultures are extremely maternalistic, bizarrely. Like, young vultures stay with their family, immediate family group, until they're equivalent of like late teenagers. They don't get booted out really early, so they hang around with their parents until they're fairly old. And so maybe that was one of the reasons that this is associated with. So, but then if you look at the other side of that, if the other main goddess is a cobra, I mean, cobras aren't renowned for their maternalistic skills. Cobras are renowned for being, particularly the Egyptian cobra, extraordinarily aggressive.
Bitey.
Yeah, they spit. They spit venom at your eyes. So they're famously capricious. So again, it's that kind of wanting something that has those qualities, something that will fight very hard on your behalf. So in the 18th dynasty, so quite late, Egypt has 30 dynasties. In the 18th dynasty, so again, this is the period of Hatshepsut, it's the period of Akhenaten, Tutankhamun, all of these things, the vulture headdress became part of the queen's regalia. So it basically is directly associating her with this particular goddess. It's a pretty interesting thing the way, and you'll notice if you look closely at ancient Egyptian crowns, most of them, you'll notice that on the top of the forehead there's a small cobra and sometimes a small vulture, and that's the two ladies basically literally sitting on the king's and the queen's forehead, protecting them, ready to attack anyone who might give them any trouble. So yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, it's a fascinating topic. I did my master's thesis on this, which was on basically female deities and their aggressive tendencies. They're not people you want to mess with.
No.
No. At all.
In a vulture-y kind of way.
Mm.
Okay. Our next piece of music is the Satisfaction Queens. I got quite queeny.
Excellent.
If I can, I'm left-handed. I'm used to a left-handed mouse, and everyone else is right-handed. So here we go.
Leave your face at the door. Turn off your swag and check your bag. From your limbs to your Timbs, get down. But whatever you do, hey, don't bump my groove. Whatever you do, don't bump my groove. Whatever you do, don't bump my groove. Whatever you do.
Whatever you do, don't bump with my groove. Whatever you do, don't bump with my groove. Whatever you do, don't bump with my groove.
patience.
Sweat
be your
cardigan.
Physicians,
you better bring yourself.
Bring yourself.
Bring yourself.
So we've just been talking about queens who weren't known, or
are very well known, but we don't know anything about them.
Yeah.
It's a super frustrating bit. So people that are kind of depicted everywhere in the art and in the text, but we don't know anything about them at all personally. Which is quite incredible. The example I was mentioning before is Queen Nefertari. So Ramses II, Ramses the Great, who was one of the greatest self-publicists of history, I think. Yeah. Ramses the Great, everyone has heard of him. Ozymandias, King of Kings, was written about one of his statues. You go to Egypt, he's everywhere, constantly telling you how brilliant he was and how great he did things. One of the main sites you go to is Abu Simbel, down in the very southern part of Egypt, which was a massive temple that he constructed, basically on the border of Egypt, saying, you know, anyone that's coming in here, this is what you're dealing with. And his principal wife, Nefertari, if you go to Abu Simbel, you have the famous temple with the four huge seated statues of Ramses II on the front of it. And just next to that is a temple to his queen, Nefertari, associating her with the goddess Hathor. And Ramses II is a really interesting character because his family were deliberately put in position on the grounds that there was a line of succession in existence. His grandfather was put on the throne knowing that his grandfather already had a son and a grandson, the grandson being Ramses II. So when Ramses II came to the throne, he had this kind of quite powerful lineage behind him. But he came to the throne, we think, when he was around 19 or 20 years old. And by this point, he was already married. He was married to Nefertari. And she held her position as his principal queen for around about 30 years. But the other thing we know about Ramses II is that he had a lot of wives. At this point in Egyptian history, basically wives were part of your political situation. You know, you married foreign princesses to create alliances, etc., etc. So he had a lot of wives, but she, throughout this, held her position as the principal queen. And you know there would have been a lot of machinations. You can imagine it would have been very kind of Game of Thrones-ish at times. And Egyptian queens, particularly during the New Kingdom, actually held quite a lot of financial power. They had their own estates, they had their own industries, their own businesses. They were generating their own wealth. So Queen Nefertari, she's married to the crown prince. He becomes king of the most powerful state on earth. He's, very busy putting his name everywhere, building temples everywhere, adding his name to everything that he can think of, having battles and saying that he won them, even though we're not sure he did. And then the inauguration of the other thing that's very frustrating in ancient Egyptian history is that they don't record the death of monarchs or queens. You simply stop hearing about them. So you'll hear about, you know, year one, two, three, this person was doing so and so, and then suddenly they're just not referred to ever again. Yeah. So you have to kind of assume that that means that they've died. We don't actually know. And with Queen Nefertari, the Temple of Abu Simbel, this was his real, you know, his masterpiece, really, in terms of architecture. We have a record of her travelling with him to the inauguration of the Temple of Abu Simbel. And then at the inauguration, there is no record of her, and their eldest daughter is the person that's actually undertaking the ceremony. So we presume that she died en route. But apart from that, she has her tomb in the Valley of the Queens is considered to be the finest tomb in ancient Egypt, the tomb of Nefertari. It's been closed on and off for a while because it's had to undergo a lot of conservation work. If you travel to Egypt, you can normally buy a ticket to visit the Valley of the Kings, the Valley of the Queens, and it'll be, say, $10 to get access to three or four tombs. Queen Nefertari's tomb, they have a very strict number of people that are allowed to go into it, and I think it costs approximately $2,000 for a ticket. So because they don't want people, a lot of people going in there. But the artwork is absolutely exquisite. So we know that she was held in extremely high stead. We know that she was obviously had a lot going for her, but we don't know, was she politically savvy? Was she just particularly loved? We have no idea. We don't know anything about her. We don't know where she came from. We don't know who she was. We don't know what she looked like. All we know is that she held this position.
Was she the wife of a bit of a narcissist? Or...
Oh, my. Yeah. I have taken very tongue-in-cheek referring to him as being kind of like the Donald Trump of ancient Egypt, because his art's really tacky and he loves putting his name over everything. You know, write my name on this, write my name on that, put a massive statue up here. Here's me. One of the most famous scenes you associate with him is the Battle of Kadesh, which he had put on the front of all of his temples, showing how he basically single-handedly defeated the Hittites in this battle. And it's a very famous tale, and the Battle of Kadesh did happen. The interesting thing is that he says that he won it, and the Hittites say that they won it. So, again, it's this kind of, you know, fake news.
Everybody's happy.
Exactly. But, again, it shows that we don't change over time. You know, how propaganda works, how kind of getting people to think that you're doing the best thing for them works, hasn't really changed over time. We might think that we're more savvy than the ancient Egyptians, but we're really not.
We voted for Donald Trump.
I didn't.
Well, no, I'm
ironically, they didn't vote for Donald Trump, but he still got the job. Yeah,
yes.
But enough people did, exactly.
As humans of our era, rather than actually doing it ourselves.
We're also very willing, as you know, all humans have through history, very willing to believe things that suit us and work for us.
Yeah.
And it's very easy, particularly in the modern world, and as you can imagine very much in the ancient world, to have that influenced by your fears, things you're afraid of happening, things you're afraid of going wrong. Because, you know, life is fragile.
Yeah,
so, sure. You know, when you're reliant on things like floods, and we're finding this more and more now with climate change, you know, as you can imagine in the ancient world, things like the floods not working or the flood being too big or storms being too violent or storms not happening at all have a huge impact. And we're seeing that now.
Hmm.
And that's kind of what's partly knocking into the way that we're starting to think in the 21st century. So things go around and come around.
And hoping it's just not happening.
Yeah, exactly. Hoping something magical up in the sky will fix it for you without him to do anything.
Another queen that I, when I was doing a little bit of background research, because it gives you a little bit more kind of context, I found that there was this queen that I hadn't heard of called T.
Queen T. Oh, I love Queen T. She's one of my favourites. Yeah, Queen T was like, she was actually Akhenaten's mum. So Nefertiti's mother-in-law. And her husband, Amenhotep III, again, what you have to bear in mind, a lot of this we're dealing with Victorian terminology that's been placed onto this. So the ancient Egyptians, this is a fun fact, that when we talk about kingdoms, the old kingdom, middle kingdom, new kingdom, those terms didn't exist in ancient Egypt. Victorian European men created those terms so we could understand where they sat in things. And in terms of royal names, the names that we use for kings in ancient Egypt aren't the names that they actually use for the kings. So the best example I can give of this is Ramses II. We call him Ramses II. The ancient Egyptians knew him as Usumatre Setepenra. That was his name as king. So if you went to ancient Egypt and Time Machine and said, can I meet Ramses II? They had no clue what you're talking about. Your person doesn't exist. Ramses was his birth name. So that's what he was called by his mum. And when you become king, you get given a different name. So when we're talking about Amenhotep III, that's not what the ancient Egyptians called him, but he was a king Amenhotep, and he was the third Amenhotep in our counting. So Amenhotep III was Akhenaten's father, and his wife, Queen T, again, he had multiple wives, including Mitannian princesses and things. Interestingly enough, ancient Egyptian princesses were never married out of Egypt. Foreign princesses could marry in, but ancient Egyptian princesses were too important to marry foreign kings. They stayed in Egypt. And so when Amenhotep, Akhenaten actually had an older brother who died before his father died. So when Amenhotep III died, Akhenaten ascended to the throne, but he was at that point still called Amenhotep. So we referred to him at the beginning as Amenhotep IV. And his mother maintained a position of extreme importance. And she changed, I think she was one of the first people to wear the vulture headdress. She held quite high status alongside her husband. She's often shown an art as of equal stature to her husband. And she remained, she effectively retired at this point to her estates up in the northern part of Egypt, in the Delta, whilst her son and daughter-in-law and their children set up their new capital city at Tell el Amarna. But she used to visit Tell el Amarna. She had, we have records of royal visits there. And the other thing that she's very well known for is her own personal diplomatic correspondence. We have letters that are written to her from foreign kings, one of which brilliantly is asking her to have a word with her son because he's scammed them on a statue they've asked for. The son, Akhenaten's promised this king a gold statue, and what he sent is actually a gilded statue. And so this king writes to Queen Tea saying, your son said he was going to do this and he didn't do it. And so it shows, that tells us that she had political power in her own right. If they wouldn't be writing to her if they didn't think she could do anything. And obviously, the famously this, if you look her up online, if you do like a Google search or something for her, you come up with this image, which I absolutely love, of her, this small wooden figurine of her, where she just looks so badass. She gives you the real stink eye. I mean, we have no idea if this is what she actually looked like, but she was clearly a very important woman. One of the interesting things about this period in Egyptian history is around year 14 of Akhenaten's reign, these women started to disappear from the record, presumably dying of natural causes. So Queen Tea is gone, Nefertiti is gone from the record. And again, there's lots of debate about what actually happened because people can change their names. And that seems to have had some kind of knock-on effect of politics at the time. We're not exactly sure what it was. But she seems to have been quite a kind of strong, stabilising force during her time as the Queen Consort, and then, as we refer to them, as the Queen Mother, even though she was the king's mother.
So would these women have been Egyptian women or...?
Most likely, yes. Yeah. The difficulty is, again, in the way the Egyptians record things, we have what we call royal and private individuals or non-royal individuals, but royal to us means immediate royal family. Mm. So you can be royal in our terms, that you could be the equivalent of a prince or a princess, but not considered to be immediate royal family. So the way that your lineage is recorded is through your relationship with the king. So you could be king's mother, king's wife, or king's daughter. They didn't tend to record the sons. Don't ask me why. You hear more about the royal women than you do about the princes, etc., until they become crown prince. So if you, so for example, so Nefertiti, we refer to as being non-royal because she didn't hold the title of king's daughter. Because she wasn't a direct descendant of a king, we say she was non-royal, but she would have been extremely high status. She would have been, the equivalent of a duchess or something at the time. So everything is determined by your relationship to the king, and this is because the king is the divine being. He's the conduit between humans and the gods. So that's all that really matters in terms of your status. So sometimes, in place of king's wife, you'll have god's wife, because the king is a god. So, yeah. But you can't be God's mother.
and you can't be a god in waiting,
No.
We don't mention them.
No, because you can't become the god. You can only have one of this particular deity. And in Egyptian, majority of Egyptian history, that deity is Horus. Horus is the living king. And you can only actually have one Horus. You can't have half a dozen of them. So when the king is on the throne and alive, he's Horus. And then when he dies, he becomes Osiris, who's Horus's father, who's dead. And the next king becomes Horus. So it's kind of, I refer to it like, but like, old rowing boat things. Come in number 9, your time is up. And then someone else takes over that boat. Yeah. So, yeah, there's only one of that particular god at any given time. Yeah.
We've got about 6 or 7 minutes to go. Just thought I'd throw a few notices out there because part of what we do is that sort of community thing. And anyone who wanted to go to the Glamophones concert has missed that because that was yesterday, and that was referring back to another
terrible notice.
Ancient civilization, because we did the Chichester Psalms, which were Hebrew in Hebrew, so we had, we had to learn how to pronounce the Hebrew in not too hideous a manner. The Glamophones will have a little break and start again on Halloween, on the 31st of October, I'm thinking that is, on the Thursday evenings from 6:30 at St Andrews. So anyone who wants to come along and start with our new season is welcome to come along and give it a try. We won't charge you the fee until you've had a try. Coming up in Labour Weekend is Paikokariki Pride, including the world's unofficial shortest Pride Parade, which is always gets a bit of coverage. But they've got a really extensive list of things going on.
It always looks like a really good time.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
And the buses are replacing trains that day, so it's going to take a bit longer probably to get there, and possibly being, you know, a little bit more challenging. What other things are coming up? We've got Naked Girls Reading on Saturday the 19th of October, which always sounds quite an interesting kind of event, so that's in a week's time. We are always thankful to the Armstrong and Arthur Charitable Trust for Lesbians. So thank you to Armstrong and Arthur. Thank you to Sarah for coming in and talking to us about Queens of Egypt. We haven't mentioned Cleopatra.
We haven't.
She's not even Egyptian.
No.
What a scam.
She's Ptolemaic. But if it's any consolation, she was the only one of the Ptolemies that bothered to learn the Egyptian language.
That's quite...
And they had 300 years.
300 years of failing to learn the language.
Yeah. So very English, isn't it? I think this is, I always thought this was one of the reasons why, particularly the British were fascinated with ancient Egyptians, because we kind of aspired to be slight, almost as conservative and as noxious as they were. But, but yeah, kind of. The Romans did the same things. Romans used to collect ancient Egyptian antiquities and aspire to be like them as well. So,
yeah. Well, I suppose if most of what you were spending your time doing was building armies and invading, then.
Yeah,
you got to see a lot of
There's a lot of the kind of unpleasant side of ancient Egyptian history that often gets ignored. People like to look at the, you know, shiny things and the nice scenery and all of these things. But yeah, they didn't muck around when it came to oppressing other peoples if they needed to and things like that. So yeah, it's a lot to deal with.
Somebody posted something recently, basically saying that all the Hebrew celebrations are they tried to wipe us out and failed.
Mm-hmm.
So they wouldn't be fooled by
no. There's I want to say 11th dynasty king who famously say height of his power, they built huge fortresses along the Nile down into the south into what is now Sudan, and he famously sent an army expedition down there, killed anyone who might be troublesome, took everyone else prisoner, burned all the crops, poisoned the wells, took away all the livestock, and left a sign saying, don't do that again. We didn't do anything. Yeah, so, you know, and then basically set up these fortresses as kind of military-controlled trading points, so nothing could get up the river without going past his knowledge and knowing what you were doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, they didn't mess around when it came to controlling the territory around them.
Which is probably how they got to be there for 3,000 years.
Exactly. Kind of shock and awe.
Beating up any troublemakers.
Yes, very much so.
Except for the Ptolemies. So.
Well, the Ptolemies came in. That was Alexander the Great, you see, came in. And he was only in Egypt for a year or so before he died. But he pulled the absolute masterstroke of coming into Egypt and saying, hey, I think I might be a pharaoh. I think I might actually be Egyptian.
Probably am.
And we're going to invest in all of your temples and give you lots of money to reinstate your traditions. They went, yeah, okay, brilliant, thanks.
Cool.
So then he left Ptolemy in charge, and you ended up with eventually Cleopatra the Seventh was the Cleopatra that we know about, mostly really from Shakespearean tales about her. So the other interesting thing about her is we have no idea really what she looked like. We don't know much about her.
Or indeed any of them.
No.
Because
we don't have... The closest you'll be able to get to that is if you actually found the bodies.
If you found the bodies and you reconstruct the faces.
And you reconstruct the faces, you can get a guesstimate of what they might have looked like, but...
Because you don't know whether they looked African...
It's very hard to... I mean, you can put them together, you can do estimates on... Obviously, bone structure you have, so you can do some skeletal stuff, that muscle, so depth of muscle on the face, but you can't reconstruct a nose or ears or lips or anything. Cartilaginous is just gone.
New stuff to come.
Yeah, hopefully in the future.
Yeah.
They'll find ways of doing it. That'd be brilliant. But
so that's us for today. We've got about 10 seconds on the way out. Thanks to Sarah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Armando for saving me this morning when I... when I thought we were off here. And all back tomorrow. Oh, back next week.
Quilted Bananas.
Quilted Bananas.
Quilted Bananas. The Quilted Bananas program plays every Sunday, 10 to 11am, with news, views and music.
A collective of presenters, advertisers, community events and discusses news of interest to lesbians, queer women and non-binary folk.
We have interviews about past and future sports and cultural events, politics, films, art shows.
The program is sponsored by the Arthur and Armstrong Charitable Trust for Lesbians.
And it plays every Sunday from 10 to 11am on Wellington Access Radio, 106.1 FM.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Thanks, New Zealand On Air, for funding the Access Internet Radio Project.